This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
All right, Sandy Rios with you today. Tony is out, and I'll be filling in for him. I am the Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association, and I do the morning show for AFR Talk, in case some of you don't know that. You can listen every morning at 8 o'clock. Well, you know, for months now, since the election of Donald Trump, we've heard almost nothing but the fact that Donald Trump obviously colluded with the Russians, otherwise he couldn't have won the election. We hear it on CNN primarily, but NBC, ABC, CBS, and of course Fox has their share of talking about it too. And so all of these investigations have started. We have a special counsel and the former FBI Director Mueller. We have Senate investigations and House investigations, lots of investigations. And so over the weekend, while Donald Trump was at the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, things were going well. It was his first face-to-face meeting with Vladimir Putin, and there was much talk about that. He met with him for almost 3 hours, and there was a lot of talk. What came out of that, it seems, was something good, a ceasefire in Syria, at least a temporary ceasefire, and other things. They've started to work together. So lo and behold, while President Donald Trump is out of the country, the New York Times does what it always does very well. It prints a story that says that the Trump team, primarily Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, met with a Russian female attorney. And there's much to say about that, but it would take the whole segment. So therefore, aha, we have evidence of collusion. Well, I can't think of anyone better to comment on all of this, whether there was collusion, whether there wasn't, whether there was interference in our elections or whether there wasn't, than my next guest, because David Satter was a former Moscow correspondent. He worked for the Wall Street Journal over there, the London Financial Times. He lived in Russia. He speaks fluent Russian. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a fellow of the Foreign Policy Institute of John Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He's done several books on Russia. One of them was made into a movie called Age of Delirium, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union. And he joins us this afternoon. Hello, David.
Hi, Sandy.
Very nice to hear your voice.
And to hear yours.
You know, David, you know how Moscow works, and you know certainly Putin intimately. In fact, you were kicked out of the country one of the last times we talked. You know the old KGB, which Putin was central to. Do you think that Moscow, led by Putin, interfered with the 2016 presidential election?
Oh, I think he certainly did. And I think that they've been interfering in other countries for a long time. In 2007, Russian hackers paralyzed the government of Estonia. And there have been constant attempts to hack into the accounts of other nations, other individuals. They hacked into my email, stole the emails, and then began publishing them in doctored form in the Russian press, and used them to make accusations against me. So there's nothing implausible about the idea that the Russians hacked into the server of the Democratic National Committee or into the private email of John Podesta. In fact, it's the same group that hacked into Podesta's email hacked into my email.
All right, but
that's a different question. There's a question.
Right, exactly.
Much more important is whether the Trump campaign cooperated with this. Because the Russians are going to hack into, are going to do everything possible to hack into sensitive computers, whether the U.S. assists them or not. And that's the real question that we're facing right now with all these investigations is to what extent, if any, was the Trump campaign involved in this, although, you know, there's clear evidence that it took place.
All right, so did you read the New York Times? It was a 9-page article that came out over the weekend, and they go into great detail about the meeting of Donald Trump Jr., and Paul Manafort and others, I think, that were invited into the room with this Russian attorney. And, of course, the New York Times claims that she was connected to the Kremlin. When I'm reading about her, I don't really see that. It sounds like the connection is pretty nebulous. But you're the expert. What do you think about that meeting, and do you think it signals collusion?
I don't think it signals collusion. I think it shows bad judgment. The woman in charge is connected with, and the Russian lawyer who's being mentioned is connected with the group that was also responsible or had a role, I would put it this way, in the creation of the Trump dossier, the famous dossier that has been so important in these charges of collusion. So, in effect, this group was peddling negative information about both candidates. Donald Trump may not have fully understood how unsavory this person is, because she may have presented herself as someone seeking to lift the ban on the adoption by Americans of Russian orphans. But there's a trick there, because this group presenting itself as interested in lifting the adoption ban wants to do it in exchange for an end to the Magnitsky Act, which penalizes Russian officials who took part in the murder of Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian lawyer who exposed a massive corruption scheme that involved the highest Kremlin leaders. So this is someone to stay away from, definitely. However, people make mistakes, and I don't think the mere fact of meeting with her for 20 minutes without resolving anything, I mean, that's the kind of slip-up that can occur in any campaign.
Well, and I think they are saying that she misrepresented herself, and of course, this is complicated. I think, David, you're talking about Fusion GPS, and I've talked about this a lot on my show. Fusion GPS is that Russian-owned company that hired the former British spy, Christopher Steele, to do this dossier on President Trump. And I don't even know if the Trump sons or if Mr. Trump himself knew about this dossier. This was 2 months at the time that the meeting took place with this woman who seems to be connected in some...
That dossier was circulating in Washington among journalists for several months before the election. But the long and short of it is, I mean, the bottom line is, with all of the controversy, with all the press coverage, with all the investigations, there is so far no evidence of any collusion between the president and Russian intelligence in order to throw the election. Now, I can't tell you that no evidence is ever going to be found. I don't know what's out there. I don't know what the investigators are going to be finding. But for the moment, people are definitely looking. So far, everyone is coming up empty. Instead of presenting real evidence, they keep announcing one supposed bombshell after another, which turns out to be based on either based on unnamed sources, people who are breaking the law by revealing the contents of an investigation to the press, or it describes some kind of meeting of a kind that, you know, people, all representatives of all candidates always have, and including meetings maybe they shouldn't have, but are not criminal. And so I think that's what we're dealing with right now.
David, I'd be really interested to change the subject just a little bit to more. I would really like to know what your thoughts were about the interaction between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. I guess my initial thought was these guys are both bulls. You know, their nature. They both have to be the alpha dog in the room. And I'm curious to know what you thought about their interaction and what it signaled to you, knowing what you know.
Well, you know, Sandy, I think that I've seen a number of these summit meetings, and this, believe it or not, was actually pretty typical. The Russians use always the same tactics. They always try to manipulate the situation. They want, when the Russians go into a meeting like that, they have two objectives. They want to, first of all, establish that there's a new personal relationship between the American president and the Russian leader. And, of course, Trump fell into that. The second thing they want to do is convince everyone that, you see, negotiations at the highest level are fruitful. So they manufacture a Syrian ceasefire between the U.S. and Russia, which doesn't involve the parties that are actually fighting and is going to be violated in the near future after everyone has forgotten the summit meeting but remembers the headline. So I would say that this was a pretty typical summit meeting. Trump showed that he was no dumber than any other president, but definitely no smarter. And hopefully he's going to, as he sees Putin's behavior and as he becomes more accustomed to his role as leader of the United States, his understanding will improve. Now, I should say that he avoided the worst. He made clear that this country backs our allies, especially with his speech in Poland. And he made clear that he's not planning to remove those sanctions until the consequences of Russian aggression have been liquidated and the aggression has been liquidated. So he didn't, he didn't completely screw up, but he didn't understand any better than Obama, George Bush, Bill Clinton understood, the nature of the person that he was dealing with.
It's hard to the nature of the functioning of the KGB is almost beyond comprehension. You told me once the story of the tangled web and the double, triple game that they play. It's almost incomprehensible. And knowing that, David, would you, if you were advising the president, would you advise him to work with Putin in any way or just completely avoid the Russians?
I would not advise him to have an early summit meeting with Putin. And I would advise him to settle as many questions as possible. There are some questions that can be settled. They don't require the president. They can be settled at a low level, a much lower bureaucratic level. And once that's done, a meeting with the American president should be a reward for good behavior. No good behavior, no meeting, because it's a gift of legitimacy to someone who doesn't deserve it.
David Satter, always a pleasure. Let me recommend his books again. I've learned so much from David through the years about what's going on in Russia. And I think he has a real heart for the country in spite of the leadership. It's Age of Delirium, The Decline and Fall of the Soviet Union, Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State, and Age of Delirium are three of his books. David Satter, always a pleasure. Take care, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay, Sandy, take care.
My pleasure. Bye. All right, Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins on Washington Watch. Be right back after this.
Every day, Americans put their trust in doctors who have sworn the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm. We expect that the care they give us will honor this oath to the best of their ability. So why would a doctor participate in physician-assisted suicide? It directly contradicts this oath, leaving our people vulnerable to medical practices that lack safety and integrity. Earlier this year, Washington, D.C. joined Washington State, Vermont, Oregon, California, Colorado, and Montana in legalizing physician-assisted suicide. As a physician of over 25 years and a strong supporter of patient rights and access to quality care, U.S. Representative Brad Winstrup has led the charge in Congress to repeal the D.C. law and ensure safeguards are put in place that protect our nation's most vulnerable citizens. To learn more about what Congress is doing on this issue, go to frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
So what would you do with an extra $500 a month in your budget? $500. This isn't hypothetical, by the way. This is something you may need to think about very soon if you decide to become a member of MediShare. MediShare is a way to pay for your health care, and typically it costs $500 less per month for a family versus other health care plans. So seriously, think about this. You could pay off loans, pay down a mortgage, save the money for retirement, donate to charity. That would be a big deal. But you know what? Here's the best thing. MediShare works. It has 250,000 members, and it's growing fast. With MediShare, not only do you save, you don't have to pay for things you don't believe in either, and that is a beautiful thing too. So here's how you can find out more, and you might actually wind up saving even more than $500 a month. So check into it. Here's the number. Call 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23, now available in Montana. 855-PSALM-23.
Hi, this is Dan Celia from Financial Issues. You know, the charitable gift annuity concept is more important today than probably ever. It is something that you have heard me talk about for many, many years. And right now, for now, the tax code is still allowing charitable organizations to establish a charitable gift annuity so that you can be guaranteed permanent income for the rest of your life. Don't waste any time. So many of you have IRAs, 401k money. Peel off a piece of that. Establish your charitable gift annuity so that you have a portion of permanent income that you know is never going to change for the rest of your life. Would you do it today? Call AFA Foundation, 800-326-4543. Extension 345. That's 800-326-4543. Extension 345.
You said after you were dismissed, you gave information to a friend so that friend could get that information into the public media.
Correct.
What kind of information was that? What kind of information did you give to a friend?
That the Flynn conversation, that the president had asked me to let the Flynn, I mean, I'm forgetting my exact own words, but the conversation in the Oval Office.
So you didn't consider your memo or your sense of that conversation to be a government document? You considered to be somehow your own personal document that you could share with the media as you wanted to?
Correct.
Through a friend?
I understood this to be my recollection recorded of my conversation with the president. As a private citizen, I felt free to share that. I thought it very important to get it out.
So were all of your memos that you recorded on classified or other documents memos that might be yours as a private citizen?
I'm sorry, I'm not following the question.
Well, I think you said you'd use classified.
Not the classified documents. Unclassified. I don't have any of them anymore, but I gave them to the special counsel. But, yeah, my view was that the content of those unclassified, the memorialization of those conversations was my recollection recorded.
All right, well, that's actually the bombshell that developed the last 48 hours. It isn't the New York Times article about some collusion with the Russians. I have a lot more to say about that if I had the time. But let me just say that I think you're going to be hearing more about what that meeting was all about. And I'll leave it to others to explain it. But this is a story about the former FBI Director Comey, and that was his testimony before the Senate committee, and that was Senator Roy Blunt speaking up. And by the way, sorry, this is Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. Tony is out. It's my pleasure always to sit in his seat. I usually do the 8 o'clock in the morning show, the morning drive show for AFR Talk, and love to have you join me sometime if you can do that. Let me just say that Comey is there telling Roy Blunt, the senator from Missouri, that he had decided that, he said, this is his exact words, my view was that the content of those unclassified memorialization, I haven't even heard of that word, of those conversations was my recollection recorded. My view, that's what he says, my view. Well, we're finding out something really interesting. This is just one source. John Solomon wrote just yesterday, more than half of the memos former FBI Chief James Comey wrote as personal recollections of his conversations with President Trump about the Russia investigation have been determined to contain classified information. This revelation raises the possibility that Comey broke his own agency's rules and ignored the same security protocol that he publicly criticized Hillary Clinton for in the waning days of the 2016 presidential election. And yet, let me repeat this. He said, you heard in that interaction, former FBI Director Comey said, my view was that the content of those unclassified pieces was my recollection recorded. Well, that's a lot of words. But you know what? It's just not true. In fact, seven memos out of the nine conversations he had with Trump, he released seven memos to his friend, I guess, who leaked it to the New York Times or the Washington Post. And then four of those memos had markings making clear that they contained information classified as secret or confidential, according to officials directly familiar with the matter. And this is the part that maybe people don't fully understand. FBI agents have to agree to a lot of things in order to be agents. If I have time, I'll get into a second one, but I'll talk about this particular one. FBI policy forbids any agent from releasing classified information or any information from ongoing investigations or sensitive operations without prior written permission and mandates that all records created during official duties are considered government property. Quote, unauthorized disclosure, misuse, or negligent handling of information contained in the files, electronic or paper of the FBI, or which may acquire, I may acquire as an employee of the FBI could impair national security, place human life in jeopardy, result in the denial of due process, prevent the FBI from effectively discharging its responsibilities, or violate federal law. That's an agreement that every single FBI agent signs. There's more to it. I could read more to you, but let me just say that Comey was the head of the FBI. Now there's some of the defendants say, well, maybe he didn't sign that. It doesn't matter. It was FBI policy. And he was the head of the FBI. And the rules apply to him just like they do to the agents. In other words, the notes that agents take when they go out on cases, they take notes all the time. They are not for public consumption. An agent can't just turn around and release them to the press. And so, and then in addition to this, it looks like Comey's memos contained secret or confidential level information. And that's the exact same thing that Hillary Clinton was accused of. Same statute. And which he said that, you know, she was careless, but there would be no charges brought and no reasonable prosecutor would bring charges. And of course, we know that that was just really disgraceful. And we're learning so many more disgraceful things about the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I have to tell you that former agents are, not all of them, but lots of them, are very embarrassed and distressed by what they see happening to their agency. And under the leadership of, still, McCabe, the second in charge to Comey is still running the agency, and he has three major investigations against him, not the least of which his own personal abuse. Now, abuse is not strong enough a word. His wife received $700,000 from Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia, to run as a Democrat in the Senate race in Virginia. And McCabe, who was required by FBI rules and regulations to record all of his income, his wife's income, every year, I know this personally, and sign on the dotted line at all of your income, all of your assets, everything can be accounted for, did not reveal that. And then Director Comey put McCabe in charge of the investigation of Mrs. Clinton's email. It is just almost beyond fathoming, but that is where we are. The FBI, I think, has become corrupt. I don't know if you saw the FBI agent give a briefing after the shooting of Steve Scalise and the attempted murder of the Republicans on the baseball field. The FBI agent that gave the briefing was embarrassing. He said that the shooter just must have just happened to be by. They didn't see any motivation that they the directions that he had drawn and the surveillance he had done did not qualify as surveillance. That he just must have happened on the field and they couldn't be quite certain. He was going through a hard time in his life. This was the FBI agent overseeing, is the FBI agent overseeing that case. We must clean out our agencies. And I'm hopefully, God willing, President Trump will be able to do that. This is Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. I'll be right back after this. We'll be right back.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
The president for America's Tax Reform, Grover Norquist, was on with Maria Bartiromo on one of the Sunday programs on Fox Business. And, of course, Paul Ryan said this week that he believes that tax reform is going to get done. And Grover Norquist says the same thing. Listen to what he said.
The speaker's making it clear and the president's making it clear that we're going to do tax reform this year. And or tax reduction this year, and taking the corporate rate from 35 to 15 should be understood not simply as a tax cut, which it is, but it's also fundamental tax reform, because if the corporate rate is not 35, highest in the world, but down to 15, one of the lower rates in the world, then we don't have a lot of our international trade problems. It is reform. It solves many of our international trade problems.
Well, it certainly will solve a lot of international trade problems. That is for sure. 15 rate, which would be one of the lowest in the world, would have a huge impact. Here's what I don't believe, though. I don't believe it's going to be made retroactive to January 1st. I'll be shocked if it is. This thing's not likely to get passed till sometime in September, maybe October, who knows? And it's not likely that they're going to give up the revenues that they've had to date or have that revised in any way, shape, or form and look like they're going to want to start January 2018. But here's the deal. If they do, if they just pass this and it's no longer an uncertainty, but now we have tax reform coming and we know that it's going to happen, then yes, Grover Norquist is absolutely right. We are going to start seeing some of that money coming in from offshore, and we are going to see corporations gearing up, getting ready for 2018, and it is going to have a positive impact for the rest of the year on our economic growth.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
This is Washington Watch, and Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. You know, they do such great work, Family Research Council, and you can get so much of their resources at frc.org, and you can, you know, kind of be in touch with Tony on his Twitter account. It's @T Perkins, and you can kind of get the latest. You know, I find that Twitter is actually, I'm beginning to understand. Well, I've been understanding for a while, but I was slow to come to it. I couldn't bring myself to say the word. It sounded so ridiculous that I was going to tweet. Of course, that's been a long time ago. That was when I was on the radio in Chicago, but now I do tweet. Yes, I do. I can't believe I find it still difficult to say it, but I do. And you can find my tweets, oh brother, at Sandy Rios tweet. At Sandy. It's hard to take myself seriously. At Sandy Rios tweet. But it's a pleasure to fill in for Tony. I do the morning show here at AFR Talk. And of course, AFR is a part of the American Family Association that I represent in Washington. You know, AFA and FRC are great partners. We do a lot of things together, and Tony Perkins and Tim Wildman work together very closely. So we're great partners, kind of trying to move this ship along and trying to be salt and light in the nation's capital. Well, what was it? It was in January. Remember the Women's March? I certainly do. I remember seeing it with my own eyes. It was just pretty appalling. I saw children dressed up in things that you can't describe and adult women dressed in things you can't describe. And one of the organizers for that march was a woman named Linda Sarsour. Linda Sarsour is an Islamist. She is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. She wears a hijab and has a lot to say. And this is what she said at the Women's March.
Respect the presidency, but I will not respect this president of the United States of America.
Well, thank you for sharing, Linda. And she's not done, because she spoke at the 54th Annual Convention in Chicago of the Islamic Society of North America last weekend and called for jihad against the Trump administration. Now, let me explain a little bit about what she's talking about. First of all, the Islamic Society of North America, that's ISNA, was an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation trial. That's when the FBI used to be the FBI. That was a very serious investigation into the Muslim Brotherhood, in which they uncovered all of the secret plans that the Muslim Brotherhood had by their own hand, they wanted to destroy the United States of America from within. They listed all of their partners. It was Council for American Islamic Relations. It was ISNA. It was the Islamic Students Association. And I could go on and on. It was a huge, long list. And it says in the document, They want to destroy our miserable house from within. And yet somehow we have managed to elect Muslim Brotherhood sympathizers, even on the Republican side of the aisle. Some so-called conservative Republicans embrace operatives of the Muslim Brotherhood. It really is shocking. Well, Linda Sarsour doesn't hide that. She's part of that branch. She spoke to the 54th Annual Convention of the Islamic Society of North America in Chicago. But I want you to hear kind of a little bit of what she said. Let's listen.
I hope that we, when we stand up to those who oppress our communities, that Allah accepts from us that as a form of jihad, that we are struggling against tyrants and rulers, not only abroad in the Middle East or in the other side of the world, but here in these United States of America, where you have fascists and white supremacists and Islamophobes reigning in the White House.
Islamophobes reigning in the White House. So she's calling for jihad. Well, what exactly does that mean? Well, the CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations, that is the PR mouthpiece for the Muslim Brotherhood, wants you to believe that that just means, you know, that inner struggle, that strife, you know, that wanting to do good and striving in the process. But most of us understand very clearly that whether it is not chopping off your neighbor's head, the struggle is to make Islam superior, to subjugate any infidel. That's anyone that does not embrace fully Allah and Islam and the Quran. To subjugate and destroy, that's what jihad is. And jihad, whether it's violent or nonviolent, it is the same struggle for the same purpose. And of course, a lot of it is violent. Phil Haney, good friend who wrote See Something, Say Nothing. You know, Phil is that whistleblower from the Department of Homeland Security. He says that her words they carry much more weight to Muslim ears than they do to ours. He said even the word prepared carries a lot of weight. Whether violent or civilization jihad, it's the same word that is embedded within the logo of the extremist Muslim Brotherhood. Remember, the Muslim Brotherhood is on what we call stealth jihad. They do it through the system. They do it by getting officials elected, as they've been very successful. They infiltrate the conservative movement. They infiltrate everywhere. They ingratiate themselves. They start talking and looking like Americans, but their purpose is to subjugate and wage holy war. There's no question about it. And so that was Linda Sarsour. Brigitte Gabriel put it very well, as she always does. Brigitte is the founder of Act for America, Lebanese-born. Let's listen to Brigitte.
It is. It's very radical. She was specifically inciting hatred and violence. If these words were coming out of any other person, we would have said, well, you know, that really overstepped the line. But coming from Linda Sarsour, you have to understand her background. This is a lady that comes from a long line of terrorists. Her family members are, as we speak, sitting in Israeli jails for conviction of terrorism. When you look at her praising in her speech at ISNA, Imam Siraj Wahaj, who was a co-conspirator in the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. She called him her hero and her mentor. She called him how he talks to her, how she listens to his voice when she's laying in bed thinking about issues that relate in this country. And then she gives a speech at ISNA, which is the first organization
Bridget, you are hate monger number one in the United States.
You got your turn to speak. It is my turn. Yeah. ISNA is the number one organization listed in the Muslim Brotherhood plan to destroy America. The Muslim Brotherhood is the oldest Islamic terrorist organization in the world. And
all right, that's so Brigitte Gabriel, and you get the gist of it. She said what I said, only she said it better. So this woman's walking around with a huge platform in this United States calling for jihad against our president, Sandy Rios.
Hello, I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. We're going to Israel in March, and we'd love for you to come along with us. You know, one of the frequent questions I get when I talk about our trip to the Holy Land, people say to me, Tim, is it safe to go on your trip? To which I respond, you know, we won't be in New York but a few hours. So we're going to Israel. Israel is a safer than any other place in the world. They take their security very, very seriously. So if you'd like to join us as we see Jerusalem and Bethlehem and the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River and all the other places you've read about since you were a child in the Bible, we'd love to have you join us. For more information, go to the website twholyland.com. That's twholyland.com. Or for our brochure, call 800-FAMILIES. That's 800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, option 5.
challenges await a Christian ministering to a Muslim friend.
They have no mediator. You still got a holy God, you still got a broken law, and you've got the reality of hell described in even more vivid colors than anything we find in the Bible.
Dr. James White, director of Alpha and Omega Ministries, helps bridge the misunderstanding and lack of communication between Christianity and Islam. Look for the AFA Cultural Institute DVD, Reaching Muslims with the Gospel by Dr. James White, when you visit afastore.net.
Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
Your mission is to find Granny and get that sauce.
Affirmative.
1 million moms in association with American Family Studios introduces Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent.
I'm Ryan DeFrady's. I work alone.
Ryan is arrogant and reckless until the day he's paired with a very unlikely partner.
No way! I can do this alone, without anyone's help, much less my mom's.
Look, Ryan.
She's my mom!
Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent is the new action-adventure series featuring a young spy with a whole lot to learn.
Mama's coming, sweetie!
She's an agent! Get her, boys!
Each exciting, fun-filled episode teaches children important values, like honoring parents and respecting authority. And there's a brief wrap-up at the end that connects the story to a biblical illustration. Ryan DeFrady's Secret Agent. Perfect for children ages 6 and over. Order yours today at ryansecretagent.com.
All right, Sandy Rios back with you for this final segment of Washington Watch, filling in for Tony Perkins. You can find FRC's great information at frc.org, frc.org. You can contact Tony or follow him at T. Perkins. You know, the Senate is back in Washington, and I'm confident that because you listen to this show and because you are a people that pay attention, that you know that the Senate is back, and now the biggest thing facing them, and there are lots of big things, is this whole business of health care. You've heard probably that the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, is sort of hedging now, saying he doesn't think he can get enough votes because he thinks he has to have 60, or he has to have at least, they're going to use reconciliation. So if he can get over 50 votes, they can pass the current bill. But then, of course, there's a lot of controversy about this, the verbiage in the current bill. So I have a lot of thoughts about this, but we have a guest, and I'm so glad he's joined us. I wasn't sure he was going to, but because he has, I'm going to introduce him. And we're going to talk about it. You've heard his name, and certainly when he spent his time in the Senate, he made his mark. He's missed. His wisdom and his experience is very much missed. He has been an obstetrician for many, many years, and he served in the U.S. Senate for I'm not sure how many, probably 12, I'm guessing. His name is Dr. Tom Coburn from the great state of Oklahoma, and he joins us from Chicago, I think. Hello, Senator Coburn, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Sandy. Glad to be with you.
Are you still delivering babies?
No, I'm not. The Affordable Care Act eliminated my participation in medicine.
Are you kidding?
Undermined the art of medicine. No. I only have about 10 minutes.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Let me tell you what I think about what's going on.
Yes,
and
please.
I'll answer any question here.
Okay.
First of all, you don't tell people you're going to do something and not do it. That's first. And there are 52 Republican senators that all said that and voted for that. Number two is Washington isn't going to fix our health care. Never going to fix it. What is going to fix it is price discovery. And matter of fact, the meeting that I walked out of to discuss is about a new plan that's going to invade Chicago in the next 2 years. It's going to cut health care costs on a large portion of it, about 30%.
Wow.
And that's real markets with real price discovery, with real rewards for efficiency and excellence, and taking the middleman out and allowing patients and their providers the ability to do what's in the best interest of the patient without profiting somebody who doesn't do anything for them. So that's what's coming. regardless of what Washington does. And if you want to fix health care, what you need to do is get Washington out of it. And I'll give you a great example right now. About 15 years ago, the federal government, Medicare, mandated pain control in hospitals. And we started seeing opiates going home with patients like crazy because you didn't want to get dinged by Medicare because you didn't send them home with pain medicine. That's what started the opioid epidemic.
Wow.
It wasn't a drug company. It's doctors writing prescriptions. And part of the incentive for that was Medicare. And if you didn't do it, Medicare could ding the hospital. So, you know, every doctor is taught, don't prescribe opioid medicine for chronic pain. So what's out there today? Opioids for chronic pain. And we know that doesn't work because they attenuate. So we have this big problem because the government got involved in health care to begin with. So all I'm saying is if we really want to fix health care, we need to get Washington out of it. We can still have Medicare and Medicaid. We can still take care of folks that need us, but we can do it at a whole lot less cost with a whole lot better outcomes.
Well, let me just say that I'm far less intelligent and far less experienced than you, Senator Coburn, but those are exactly my thoughts. Exactly, without knowing all that you know. And so, would you say, is there any reason why the Senate can't do away with Obamacare fully? Is there any real reason why they can't do that and let the market jump in and do something?
No, other than the cowardice of members who desire to get reelected more than do what's best for the country.
Yeah.
And that's our problem, is career politicians who will say one thing and do another. I mean, every senator there has voted, actually not every senator, but most of the Republican senators there have voted to completely repeal Obamacare. So why won't they vote for it now?
Yeah.
Because
well, you know,
they might get criticized.
Well, and the other,
rather than stand up and do what needs to be done.
Well, the other more insidious reason that I hear people giving is that the ties to K Street lobbyists involved in health care are so strong. There's a lot of money to be made on continuing some of Obamacare.
Well, that may be true, but the biggest thing is what their state's Medicaid budget is and the expansion of Medicaid versus the non-expansion. If you go look at Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania and look at their Medicaid audits, just in the perusal of that, there's 1,200,000 people who signed up for Medicaid that weren't eligible.
Senator Coburn, finish your thought.
Go ahead.
No, finish your thought, please.
I'm just saying is government programs are designed to be defrauded. Why would we not expect that? So why don't we do something different? Why don't we let states run Medicaid completely?
I know you only have a few minutes, so I'm pushing you here with these questions, but if they can't vote, if they cannot reach some agreement, if they insist that the rules keep them from place having a vote to repeal, replace, or any of it, they can't agree, and Obamacare continues to die on the vine, which it's going to do, can the free market, as you're describing it, come in and start sucking away, sucking the life out of what exists of it? Can that happen without a vote being taken?
Yes, it can, and it's going to happen in the private sector. It's going to happen in the self-insurance market. It's going to happen in the individual insurance market. It's going to happen in the ERISA plan. It's going to happen everywhere except the government-run program.
This thing that you're talking about in Chicago, is this for Illinois only?
Well, no. Oh, no. No, it's being. I can't speak about it without violating confidence, but it's working now, and it's saving people thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on per event. So it's big, and it's about 30%.
Wow! Oh, that's just such good news. That is such good news. And let me ask you.
Markets work. The only places we don't use markets in America to allocate scarce resources: education, which is failing, and healthcare, which is way too costly.
As you look at the landscape as a physician, now you've already said that your practice was ruined by Obamacare, but you're still tuned in to what's happening in healthcare and to people who are sick. What is your assessment? I hear all of these so-called surveys that are taken to say that people like Obamacare and they're upset with senators for trying to take it away. What's just your gut feeling about what the reality is?
I think you don't pay attention to that. I think you pay attention to what we're, 80% of our economy is controlled by market forces. We don't use market forces in healthcare. We have the most expensive healthcare in the world. Why don't we try what works in the rest of our economy before we have the government run it? Because if you really want to know what government healthcare looks like, go to a VA hospital or an Indian Healthcare Service hospital. And there you'll find what healthcare run by the government looks like. It's a disaster.
You know,
so,
I have to...
So, simple principles. Markets work. Let's use them.
And let's try that before we have the government run more of healthcare.
You know, my husband and I were in a restaurant just this weekend, and a young girl waited on us, a beautiful young girl. She's in her 20s, single mom with two children, 3 and 5. She had a terrible limp, and I thought maybe she had a birth defect of some sort, or maybe one leg shorter than the other, something. But as we ask her about it, she has rheumatoid arthritis in her 20s. She works two jobs, Senator Coburn, two jobs, has a friend help her with child care. She cannot, she's broken her hip 3 times, and she can't afford surgery. She can't take off work because she can't support her kids, and no one wants to take care of her kids. I tell you, the situation for American people, in terms of the health care now, I think is reaching a critical situation.
It's getting ready to get a lot better without the government.
Oh, that, I'm so encouraged
Andy,
to hear you say
go.
That. All right, Dr. Coburn, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for calling in. All right, so I knew that Dr. Coburn might call in, but we weren't sure. And the one thing that I was really, I hinted to this with him, was Mike Emanuel, for instance, did a report on Fox just last night about healthcare, and he talked about the stats, about the polls that are being taken by people, that people don't want Obamacare taken away. He also talked about how Republican senators are going back to their various districts, and they're getting an earful. People coming to these town halls and saying they don't, you know, complaining. People are going to lose their health care, et cetera. You fill in the blanks. And, of course, the point I would make about that is that we're seeing from some of the leftist sources that so many of these town halls are being populated and orchestrated, these protesters, by the left. Because what their end game is, of course, is that Obamacare fails. Yes, they like that. They don't have a problem with that. They don't want the Senate bill because they don't, like Senator Coburn, they don't want some minimal level of government involvement of healthcare. What they want is an entire involvement of healthcare. They want the government to completely run healthcare. They want it to them to take it over completely. As it stands, you know, Obamacare is just a certain percentage of the population. Many of you still get your health insurance through your employer. You still have good insurance. That hasn't been tampered with yet. But if the left has its way, they will control all of the insurance. They will control whether you get certain procedures or whether you don't. You know, we look at this this young couple out of Great Britain with their child who has this birth defect of some sort and can't function. And so they had raised I think $1 million, $1 million something, to bring this baby to the United States to get treatment because they love their baby. Anybody understand that listening to me? They were desperate for help for their child. And there were doctors here in America who felt they might be able to help the baby. In the socialized medicine, there aren't money for extraordinary procedures like that. And other people decide for you whether you can have those kinds of procedures. So this young couple raised their own money to bring their baby to the United States to get this treatment. And guess what? The courts that oversee such things, through socialized medicine in Great Britain, said no. One by one, the courts said no. And finally, they appealed to the European Human Rights Commission. And the European Human Rights Commission said no. The baby doesn't have a chance. We're going to let it die. And they went so far as to say, we're going to take the baby off life support. We're going to do it. They were supposed to do it last Friday, although there have been stays and appeals, and there seems to be some movement there. But the point is, if you are under a government system, as England is, as many other countries are, where the government, oh, yes, everyone's covered, technically, but you don't have the freedom to get the procedures that you want without their permission. And, you know, certain people get more privileges than others. Don't think that healthcare will not become political if the government then starts to decide what you get and what you don't. a lot of Canadians, you know, come into the United States to get procedures that they, because there's such long waiting lists on Canada's healthcare system. And there are some procedures that they just can't even get at all. And sometimes they wait years and they can't decide for themselves. And you will recall that when President Obama was running for president the first time, he was doing a town hall, and a woman brought her mother, and her mother had a pacemaker, but her mom was, I think, in her early 90s or late 80s. And the question was this: hey, this is my mom. She's so vivacious. Hey, hi, mom. Hi, hi. Her mom was, you know, full of energy and life. And she said she just had a pacemaker because she's just so vital, and we want her to enjoy life. And under your health care plan, would she have been able to get this pacemaker? And President Obama smiled, you know, he's charming, because he's charming, you know, his charming smile. And he said something like, under my plan, basically, no, she would be too old. He said it kindly, to get a procedure like that. That's a lot of money to spend on someone that age. Maybe she could take a pill or something. That's probably what we do. We give her a pill or something. And so you see, now that's why we do not want, under any circumstance, our government controlling our health care. I am really encouraged at what Senator Coburn just said. I've been saying for a long time that we need to repeal Obamacare completely, let it die, and let the free market step in and solve this problem. We can keep Medicaid for very, very poor people. We should have a safety net. And there are other private ways to take care of people that are poor who have extraordinary problems. In the past, I think there has been a problem with that. One of the things that has made our healthcare system crack and nearly break has been the overwhelming strain on our healthcare services from illegal immigrants. Hospitals have just groaned under the weight of all of that, because illegal immigrants come to emergency rooms for their regular healthcare and they can't be denied. And the people that pay for it are you and I. And it's not possible to have a reasonable healthcare system without any kind of limits as to who can be covered. And it is citizens. You know, the Bible says, if you want to ask me, you know, the biblical view on this, it's that a person that does not take care of their own is worse than an infidel. And we know now what an infidel is, don't we? An infidel to Muslims is anyone who doesn't have true north belief in Allah. An infidel in biblical understanding is someone who does not believe in God. So if you don't take care of your own family, the Bible says that you are worse than someone who doesn't believe in God. And it's not, a family is not just the group of people that share your last name. America is your family in a larger sense. You have a family that you have four walls and you sit down to the dinner table with, and then you have a larger family that's your country. And so America is our family. It's our job to take care of our family first. And then with what we have and our ability, we help the world. America has done that. Have we not? Have we not done just about probably more than any country prior to the founding of this country for other countries in terms of meeting their needs? And God bless America for doing that. We can still do that, but not at the expense of our own children and our own future. All right, well, this has been Sandy Rios filling in for Tony Perkins. Again, frc.org, at T Perkins. If you want to connect with me, I'm on the morning show at 8 o'clock, and it's at Sandy Rios Tweet. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.